student had to study that particular mother from beginning to end, and he should not come out with a spirit, filled with belligerence, where he spends a final year in a class where for 1 week the issue of raf'ul yadayn is being treated from the one perspective only, and the kind of things that go together with it. Now, we've all had teachers who treat these particular ikhtilafat with the greatest of sensitivity. I remember my own ustad, Mawlana Ni'matullah Azami, any mas'ala of khilaf, he used to say, Hamare Imam Shafi'i, our Imam Shafi'i, our Imam Malik, with great sensitivity. And you do find those other fellows also. If you Shafi'is believe that money is tahir, why don't you eat it? Na'udhu Billah. You do find that too. Now, I don't believe that it's in the interest of our future that ikhtilafat between madhahib must be treated in this particular manner. If there is a fight to be fought, it's against the mubtadi'ah. If there's a fight to be fought, it's against those who are bent upon the destruction and the transmogrification of sharia in the present world. If there's a fight to be fought, then it is against those that would take the concept of maslaha and make it ride completely over the nas. That is the, those are the thuhur upon which we should be preparing the cadres of tomorrow to be standing in defense of Islam. As for the masail khilafi بين المذاهب, I believe, Allahu A'lam, that if one looks at these ikhtilafat in the light of the usul of the madhahib, then a very easy solution is to be found. The easy solution is this madhab has this particular approach in usul, therefore it arrives at that particular opinion. This madhab has a different approach, and therefore they arrive at that opinion. I was teaching this in the Tirmidhi class once upon a time, and produced a synthesis of this nature, or explanation of this nature. And a student puts up his hand, he says, Mawlana, but... I say, yes, but what? He says, yes, but we can argue against it by saying this. I say, I know that. I know that argument, and I know the counter-argument, and the counter-argument to that as well, but that's not our purpose. Our purpose is not polemics. Our purpose is not to prove which madhab is rajih. Our purpose is to create the harmony, the brotherhood between the madhahib in such a way that we will all jointly be able to stand shoulder against shoulder and face the real threats that are coming from the outside. So, we'll restrict it up to that. I had a very hard time. Not a hard time, but I was perplexed when I was finally a student in Darul Uloom Deoband, and now comes exam. How do I write my exam? The teacher expects you to write in terms of what he said in class, and I don't believe what he said in class is right. If I'm going to write my own thing, he's going to mark me down. If I'm going to write him what he says, then I'm in trouble in terms of what I myself believe, so what do I do? So I decided, let's do it this way. Let's say Madhab A has this usul and therefore they are correct. Madhab B has this usul and therefore they are also correct. My teacher liked it so much that he gave me full marks for that. I believe that particular initiative is something that needs to be rolled out on a wider level. On a wider level, that the entire approach to these ikhtilafat between the madhahib must not become the acrimonious battleground where people fight against one another. Because once we start fighting against one another, then we are self-destructing. Whatever we have, I remember the time when Sayyidina al-Hasan ibn Ali ibn Abi Talib and Sayyidina Muawiyah ibn Abi Sufyan were marching against one another. And Sayyidina Hasan says that he looks at it, two great armies of Muslims marching against one another. They're going to decimate, they're going to destroy one another, and the Romans are waiting on the border. The moment Muslims have self-destructed in this particular way, they will simply march in, there will be no army left to defend. And therefore he decided in the year 40 after the Hijrah to place his hands in the hands of Muawiyah, make bay'ah, and what came about? Amul Jama'ah. And Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam predicted this by saying, إِنَّ بَنِي هَذَا سَيِّدٌ عَسَى اللَّهُ أَن يُصْلِحَ بِهِ بَيْنَ فِئَتَيْنِ عَظِيمَتَيْنِ مِنْ أُمَّتِي. In that same spirit, I believe that we can find the common grounds. And the common grounds lie hidden, I believe, Allahu A'lam, in the area of usul. If we can understand ikhtilaf in the light of usul, then that's where we should go. Okay, back to the curriculum, however. We need to treat then furu', we need to treat usul, we need to treat also qawaid, so that the student has a good grasp of all of them. What we have done initially, right in the beginning, first year students, they don't know much of an Arabic thing, so a bit of the first half of the year, a bit of the Mabadi Fiqhiyya, the one that Watawal Islamic Institute produced. There's about four parts to it. Couldn't really call them volumes, they are quite small. But that's an initial reader for 6 months of the year only. For the following 6 months of the year, first year, for the following 6 months of the year, the matn of Abu Shuja'. Just the matn, and more for linguistic purposes than for the fiqh. But a bit of fiqh with it as well. Now comes the second year. The second year was a bit of a problem. Do you do now one of the classical mutun? Do you do Amdatul Salik? Which you do? I found that one of the major deficiencies within tamadhub, within the manner in which the madahib are conducting or sustaining the madhab right now, is that they tend to do it in terms of mutun. Mutun la ta'tani aslan bid dalil. A matn that just states the mas'ala, that is it. Whether it be umda, whether it be safina, whether it be muqaddima, all of those, they just deal with the mas'ala and they move on. So teaching fiqh in that particular way, in an era where the, what do we call it now, the shi'ar of fiqh al-dalil is so high, where there is a claim that these people of the madhahib don't know the dalil. We know the dalil. Who are the we? That particular group there, the people of fiqh al-dalil, where they say madhahib are not required any longer. We have the adillah. You buy a copy of the translation of Bulugh al-Maram, and there you have all your adillah in front of you there. You buy a copy of the Quran, you have all your adillah in front of course, the translation thereof. And there you go. Who needs a madhab or anything else? It reminds of what happened under after the Murabitun in North Africa and Spain, they came the Muwahidun. And the Muwahidun were Zahiri in Madhab. They weren't Maliki, they were Zahiri in Madhab. So they declared to all the Qadis at that time, every Qadi forget the Maliki Madhab. Every Qadi is given a copy of the Quran and a copy of Sunan Abu Dawud. There you go, you're a Qadi, go and judge. Yeah, it didn't last for very long. The poor Qadi, now husband and wife come in front of him, and the husband says, you know, I told my wife, get out of the house. And now the Qadi, he can't ask what did you intend, because there's no ayah in the Quran that says what did you intend. There's no hadith like that. The fuqaha who worked out the whole kinaya thing worked it out according to some kinds of rules that are not there in Abu Dawud and not there in. So it wasn't long before the Qadis came back to the Sultan and says, please change the rules. We can't judge according to Kitab and Sunnah just like that. It's a noble sentiment, but very, very impractical on ground level. So the marhala zamaniya mubarakah through which we are moving says that the madhahib need to revisit their adillah in order to gain confidence that my madhab is based upon dalil. It stood for 1,000 years. It was based upon dalil. Now the shi'ar of fiqh al-dalil is being raised. It's a challenge for us to revisit our adillah and to know where we are coming from. So in this regard, I thought, what should be done? Which book could be included? The solution to my particular problem that I had there was, I included in the second year the book, Al-Fiqh al-Manhaji, in three parts. Al-Fiqh al-Manhaji, written by Dr. Mustafa Saeed al-Khin, who passed away recently, Dr. Mustafa al-Bugha, and Sheikh Ali al-Shurbaji. Three parts in contemporary Arabic, not the Arabic of yesteryear. Contemporary Arabic, because it's important that the student also be exposed to Arabic as it's being used today and not as it was used yesterday. The Arabic of Hidayah and the Arabic of Mughni al-Muhtaj and the Arabic of Sharh al-Muhaddab is a wonderful Arabic. But when you come out speaking that Arabic, you know, you sound like Shakespeare saying thee and thou. It doesn't quite come across very well. Where dost thou goest and all those things doesn't sound quite well. So therefore, we are sometimes, there's a disconnect between the Arabic that we read and the Arabic that is being used on the street. So anyway, it's written in contemporary modern idiom, plus every mas'ala is expressed in light of his dalil. Every dalil is referenced to his source as well. And it might seem like a voluminous thing to read within 1 year, but you know, to read 5 pages of that book, it takes you less time than to read half a page of one of the classical ones, because classical mutun are pregnant in meaning. They are pregnant in meaning, and the teacher needs to spend time to say what exactly does the author mean, analyze it word for word, sentence for sentence. It takes a long time. So the intention between this book is here, first of all, cover the entire spectrum of fiqh, but gain confidence. The student must gain confidence in his madhab as being based upon Quran and Sunnah. Thereafter, from the third year upwards, there are two approaches that could be used. One is an incremental approach, where you do one book, and then another book, and another book. Like, for example, in the Darul Uloom, they would do Nur al-Idah, and then Quduri, and then Kanz, and then Sharh al-Wiqaya, and then Hidayah. Every level increasing upon the other. Alternatively, another approach of using one book and spreading it over a number of years. One book, that's what we eventually chose. And which book should be chosen? I felt that for the reasons that I outlined earlier, one of the major shuruh of the Minhaj have to be dealt with. Because there, you're not just going to deal with the matn of the Minhaj and the Istirah, you will also deal with the development of the madhab thereafter. You will be exposed to authors and works of the fuqaha of the madhab, both before the shaykhain and after the shaykhain. The tarjih of the latter stage will be given as well. And of the three major shuruh, Mughni, Tuhfa, Nihaya, Tuhfa is a not very easily written book. It's a challenging book. Ibn Hajar Haytami has the tendency of, I think he's the original person who invented the Jumla Mu'tarida. Starts with the Mubtada'iyya and the Khabar come 3 pages later. So it can be quite challenging at times. Mughnil Muhtaj is the most easily written one of the lot. Very easy style. And it's a book of a Talib al-Ilm, whereas Tuhfa Nihaya, the books of the Mudarris more. So we settled on Mughnil Muhtaj. And what we do, for the 1 year we deal with the Ibadat section of it. 1 year we will deal with the Nikah and Talaq section of it. 1 year we will deal with the Mu'amalat. And then the other year for the remaining things. We did not structure it in a manner that in the final year we just do hadith and nothing but hadith. There's no Dawratul Hadith as such. The Dawratul Hadith rather has been structured in a way that the six books cover the 4 years. They're not all kept into 1 year. Bukhari, Muslim done over 2 years, the final 2 years. And then Tirmidhi done from the third year onwards, already third and fourth year, with selections from the other ones done from elsewhere. The Dawratul Hadith was never part of the Dars-e Nizami. Dars-e Nizami used to just be up to where? Up to Mishkat. And the Dars-e Nizami used to be overloaded in terms of the rational, you know, Mullah Sadra, Mullah Hassan, Shamsi Baziga, and books that Allah knows alone what they contain. Maulana Rashid Ahmad Gangohi, rahmatullahi alayhi, was very vehemently opposed to all of these books. He says these books contain Aqaid Kufriya. They shouldn't even be taught in the first place. Shah Waliullah was the person who brought back the reading of the hadith books to India. The reading of the hadith books, he brought them into vogue. And initially the students at Darul Uloom Deoban used to do up to Mishkat in Deoban only. Then they go to Gangoh and they read the Sihah Sittah to Mawlana Gangohi. First Tirmidhi for the first half of the year or so, then Bukhari and then the rest. They used to read all of them by one teacher, by Mawlana Gangohi. His student, Mawlana Muhammad Yahya Kandawi, the father of Mawlana Zakariya, used to sit and take down his taqreers, his notes. And on those notes, Mawlana Zakariya would afterwards write, Lami'ud Durari and Al-Kawkabud Durri, which is Hawashi, upon the taqreerat compiled by his father of the Durus of Mawlana Gangohi, rahimahumullahu ajma'in. So, eventually then, the Dawratul Hadith was brought into the Madaris itself too. But the reason for having the Dawratul Hadith in that particular way, I think can be seen in the light of particular developments and the academic legacy of North India specifically. The academic legacy of North India traces itself back to Central Asia. Central Asia, Mawarao Nahar and those areas. From there, with the coming of the Mongols, the ulama from there migrated two directions. Those that did not get killed migrated in one of two directions. Eastwards into the Mughal Empire, and westwards into Syria and Egypt and elsewhere. So those who came with that particular legacy. With the legacy of who? Fakhruddin Razi, and to some extent Mullah Sadra as well. If you know Mullah Sadra, he's Sadruddin Shirazi, he's a Shia philosopher of Safavid Iran. But anyway, he's seen as a leading philosopher, so his books used to be taught, and like him, many other philosophers. So the intellectual legacy of Northern India was very, very rational. More rational than textual. Shah Waliullah insisted upon that fine, that 1 year of reading the hadith books in order to drown the students in the sound of Qala Allah, Qala Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. It was only later that an in-depth study, practically a polemical analysis would be undertaken of the Bab Zeta Mukhtalafi. When Mawlana Gangohi used to teach it, there wasn't 1 week spent on Raful Yadain or another 1 week spent on Qiraat Khalf al-Imam. It was an easy understanding when anyone moves on. But when the Ahlul Hadith in India arose initially, and they became a challenge to the Hanafiya, then the response had to be given. So Mawlana Anwar Shah Kashmiri was the one who undertook that particular challenge, and with him so many others, Mawlana Zafar Ahmad, Mawlana Shabir Ahmad Uthmani and others, eventually to respond to a particular challenge, and therefore so much time was spent on those particular issues there. Interestingly, when the Ahlul Hadith made their appearance in India, they decided, we are not Hanafis any longer. Why are we going to follow the Hadith? Now, Shah Waliullah, when he brought the reading of the Hadith books into vogue in India, he knew the potential that this has of creating people who want to be hadith orientated and will abandon the madhab. So he did not leave it without parameters and without guidelines. He gave them very clear guidelines as well. Iqdul jid fi ahkam al-ijtihad wa taqleed. In this particular book, he sets out the rules. He set out the rules how to go about, how do you understand these things. And within every madhab, there will come a time when a faqih of that madhab or a student of that madhab is going to experience tension between the hadith which he reads and the fiqh which he has inherited. He's going to come across a hadith which says, that Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam was making salah and Sayyidah Aisha radiallahu anha reached out and touched his foot, and he continued to the salah, so his wudu did not break. And a Shafi'i will say, well, this goes against what I have inherited, what I have learned all along. So how do you deal with the phenomenon of tension between fiqh and hadith? Shahuriullah treats this particular phenomenon in there. He says there are some, and he quotes their names, there are some who say, abandon the hadith, just stay with the fiqh. There are others who say that abandon the fiqh, just go with the hadith. He says that is wrong and that is wrong as well. So where's his answer? He does his old thing. He goes to borrow the answer from the Shafi'is. He says this particular phenomenon, the best one to have treated this was Ibn Salah followed by Imam Nawawi rahimahullah. The answer that he produces for the Hanafis is Imam Nawawi's answer in the Muqaddimah Sharh al-Muhaddab. Imam Nawawi quoting Ibn Salah says that if a Shafi'i comes across a hadith that goes apparently against his madhab, he should go through the following steps. He finds the hadith going against his madhab, he should first ask and investigate what are the reasons why the madhab is going against the hadith. He's not just rushing to making amal on the hadith. First ask, you might just discover that the hadith is mansukh. You might just discover that this hadith is, mu'awwal bita'wil qawi. You might just discover that this hadith has to be brought in line with other hadith on account of a certain understanding. Or you might just discover that you've misunderstood the hadith completely. So first ask yourself, what are the reasons why the madhab appears to be out of sync with the hadith? If the reason satisfies you, your problem is at an end. If that reason does not satisfy you, it's a possibility as well, then says Nawawi ibn Salah, what you need to do then is don't just make amal on the hadith on your own. First see, is there any other mujtahid imam who practices upon that hadith? Is there Imam Malik or Imam Abu Hanif or Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal whose madhab is in line with that hadith? If you find, then go, because then it won't be your own ijtihad. It will be subscribing to the ijtihad of another mujtahid. It's more important for you to have harmony in your heart between yourself and the sunnah. You mustn't feel that they're very mukhalaf of the sunnah. It's more important that than to say that I must stay within the bounds of the madhab. So they say, in the case, if there's another faqih, another mujtahid who has expressed that opinion, then you go there. Then you practice that particular opinion and you are covered by the ijtihad of a valid mujtahid. Up to there, Nawawi leaves it alone. He says, after quoting Ibn Salah, he closes the quotation marks and he says, هَذَا حَسَنٌ بَلْ هُوَ الْمُتَعِيِّنِ. There's another leg of this thing left. What about the case if you find the hadith goes against your madhab, you're not satisfied by the explanation of the madhab, and you don't find any other faqih and other mujtahid expressing opinion according to it? Nawawi did not deal with that, neither did Musarah. The one who dealt with it was Imam Taqiyuddin Subki. Taqiyuddin Subki in his risala, ma'na qawlil imam al muttalibi idha sahha al hadith fahuwa madhabi. He says that if you do encounter a situation or you come across a hadith and you find no other mujtahid has expressed an opinion, his answer to this the question is that فَلْيَعْتَبِرْ نَفْسَهُ قَائِمًا بَيْنَ النَّبِيِّ صَلَّى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ وَسَلَّمَ وَبَيْنَ إِمَامِ مَذْهَبِهِ. Which of the two would you follow in that case? That's Imam Subki's opinion. He says that in that case you follow the hadith. I would add to that, that is not open for the general public. That should be kept limited to the circles of the fuqaha. To the fuqaha who have a good understanding of fiqh as well as hadith. Subki is speaking of people such as him. People such as him, if that door should be open, I think chaos could well ensue from there. The kind of chaos which we have seen ensue from elsewhere. I mention it for the sake that لِلْفَائِدَ حَتَّى يَكُونُ الْجَمِيعِ عَلَى خِبْرَ وَعِلْمٍ بِالْمَسْأَلَةِ. But not for the sake of propagation. That kind, that is kept in one particular risala somewhere, the fuqaha generally did not open that door for everyone. But in the event it does happen, and it's very rare for something like that to happen, I imagine in one or two cases that this might be a case of something like that. Upon further investigation, I found that it's adequately covered in some of the other parameters that already exist elsewhere. So I have yet to come across a case of that nature. Wallahu a'lam. Shahuriullah suggested same kind of thing, that the people who are going to read hadith, they are definitely going to come across situations where there's tension between the fiqh and hadith. Shafi'is will have it much less. Shafi'is are going to suffer from this particular phenomenon much less. They are going to have it, most certainly. There are hadith within the Sihah Sitta that go against the Shafi'i, apparently are not in line with the Shafi'i madhab as well. But the Hanafiyya and the Malikiyya have a bit of a harder time in that regard. They need to study it with more assiduity, because there is a certain system, there is a certain understanding that needs to be injected in the mind of the student in order for him to properly see the harmony between the Hanafi madhab and the hadith. As for the Shafi'is, they will have it, but at a much lower degree. And these are the various peculiarities of the madhab as they exist. Anyway, I'm coming back to Maulana Gangohi. When the Ahlul Hadith made their appearance, Maulana Gangohi advised him, he said, don't call yourself Ahlul Hadith. Call yourselves what? Call yourselves Shafi'is. Because in reality, you are doing things which are already part and parcel of the Shafi'i madhab. You are making Raful Yadain. You are making Qirat Khalf al-Imam. You are making Amin bil Jahar. In these few masail, you are falling in line with the Shafi'i madhab. It's not your own ijtihad. You haven't invented anything else. It's the same old wheel. So don't take yourself beyond the pale of tamadhub completely.